crime.
Expert witnesses testified George Floyd died from an officer's weight on his neck.
The cause of death is a low level of oxygen.
What happens now to the defense's argument that it was drug use that killed Floyd?
I'm Steve Inskeep with Rachel Martin, and this is Up First from NPR News. Protesters clashed with police in Belfast. Northern Ireland is part of the UK, but residents feel cut off by a new border due to Brexit. It's one of the last shreds of the old British Empire, and some ask how long they can stay.
As President Biden acts on gun control at the federal level, in Colorado, efforts to pass stricter gun measures are stalling.
So you can ban all you want, and they work around it.
10 people died in a mass shooting there just a few weeks ago. Is any gun regulation in that state likely to change? Stay with us. We've got the news you need to start your day.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One, offering Capital One Shopping, a downloadable browser extension that searches various sites for shoppers. What's in your wallet? More at CapitalOneShopping.com.
Support also comes from Sattva Mattress. A good morning starts with a good night's sleep. The Sattva Classic has two layers of coils for support and comfort at half the price of retail stores. Visit Sattva at SAATVA.com/NPR.
The trial of a former Minneapolis police officer turns on this question. Can defense lawyers show that George Floyd's death was different than it seemed on video?
An officer's knee to Floyd's neck last year prompted nationwide demands to reckon with racism. At a murder trial, lawyers for ex-officer Derek Chauvin hope to show the facts are subtly different. They've begun to question whether drugs killed Floyd. But an expert, police surgeon Dr. Bill Smock, says Floyd's death was as it seemed. He has no doubt the cause was Chauvin's weight on Floyd's neck.
Mr. Floyd died from positional asphyxia, which is a fancy way of saying he died because he had no oxygen left in his body.
Where's that leave the defense?
Joining us again from Minneapolis, NPR Cheryl Corley. Cheryl, good morning.
Good morning.
So we heard a clip there. Can you tell us more? I mean, what was the sentiment from medical experts who were on the stand yesterday?
Well, we had one main witness was Dr. Martin Tobin. He's a well-known physician who studies the respiratory system. And prosecutors just asked him to review the medical records and videos tied to this case. And he said, in his opinion, that Floyd died from shallow breathing, that he just didn't have enough oxygen getting into his lungs, and that damaged his brain and caused his heart to stop.
And did he make the connection? I mean, what did he say was the cause of the low oxygen levels?
Yeah, well, he said that there were four main forces, and Derek Chauvin's knee on his neck was one of them. Another knee on his back was like the second. And then he said Floyd laying prone on his chest in the street, and finally how officers pushed on the handcuffs that were on Floyd's wrist.
Forcing his left wrist up into his chest, forcing it in tight against his chest, forcing it high up. And you have to keep in mind that the opposite side of this is the street. So he was being squashed between the two sides.
And Tobin explained many of the technical details he was talking about, including how oxygen makes its way into our bodies by using video and exhibits that he had created himself.
I mean, it's always hard to read the jury from a distance, but any sign of the effect that that testimony had on those folks?
Well, you know, according to the pool reporters who were in the courtroom, the jurors were just very engaged with Tobin. He spoke directly to them. It was kind of like he was in a classroom. He asked them to follow along, to put their hands on their necks or a finger in the ear as he explained these concepts. And many of the jurors did. And that got to be really a bit much for defense attorney Eric Nelson, who objected, and Judge Peter Cahill stepped in.
Members of the jury, the witnesses asked you to do certain things. These are not required. You may do them, and he should phrase it more in terms of if you were to do that. And if you wish to do it, that is your choice.
So how did the defense respond to this medical testimony?
Well, Eric Nelson returned to his theory that it was drugs that affected Floyd's oxygen levels and caused his death. He asked Dr. Tobin to consider a hypothetical since an autopsy found fentanyl and methamphetamine in Floyd's body.
Is it fair to say that you would expect the peak fentanyl respiratory depression within about 5 minutes?
Right. I mean, obviously, it would depend on how much of it was ingested.
And Tobin added, though, that it wasn't drugs but body weight on Floyd's neck and back that stopped that flow of oxygen to his brain and caused his death.
And quickly looking forward, who's testifying today?
Well, we think Dr. Andrew Baker, the medical examiner for the county, he has called Floyd's death a homicide, and we expect to hear from him.
All right, NPR's Cheryl Corley in Minneapolis. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, Northern Ireland, where political violence took generations to settle, is suddenly unsettled again.
Protesters clashed with police in Belfast last night. Those protesters have been throwing Molotov cocktails for days. Northern Ireland, you will recall, is part of the UK and politically separate from Ireland itself. Imperial Britain had to concede Ireland's independence more than a century ago, but held on to that one portion. And the divide between a mostly Catholic nation and a mostly Protestant enclave drove decades of violence. A peace deal in the 90s assured that mostly Protestant Northern Ireland would stay in the UK, but a new border as part of the Brexit deal has thrown its future into question.
A lot of history to take into account here. We've got NPR's Frank Langfitt, who is in West Belfast. Frank, describe what's going on around you and where you are.
Rachel, I'm sitting in front of one of the peace walls. These things were built during the Troubles back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s to divide the Protestant Catholic communities. The one I'm looking at right now says there's a mural up that says there was never a good war or a bad peace. But just right now, like 10 minutes ago, there were guys, workers, actually trying to fix the peace wall because a couple of nights ago someone rammed it with a van, lit the van on fire, which is pretty emblematic of kind of the conflict we're seeing right now in the streets of Belfast.
I know it's complicated, but explain what's behind this right now.
You know, Rachel, there's several factors. Because Brexit meant leaving the European Union, the UK had to create this new internal customs border that now separates Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK, which, as Steve was mentioning, Northern Ireland is actually a part of. And what's really frustrating, although it sounds technical, people, particularly loyalists to Britain here, feel like they're increasingly distanced from their motherland. And some of them fought the Irish Republican Army during the Troubles here to remain a part of the UK, and they're frankly feeling threatened. And there's real fear over the years that at some point there will be a public vote here, which will lead to the reunification with Ireland, which is exactly what they've been fighting against. And I was talking this morning to Sarah Creighton. She's a political analyst here. And she sort of described how some loyalists who feel close to Britain, how they really feel about all this.
People are just always ultimately afraid of being betrayed or left behind or abandoned. That uncertainty, that anger, you know, that has been, it's fear, you know, and worry, I would say, for a lot of people.
I understand there are a lot of young people involved in these riots, right? What does that portend?
It's really unsettling. I was out last night, right near where I am at the moment, and there were a lot of young people with hoodies and some of them looking to be fairly young teens. And it was almost like seeing those old newsreels from the 70s and the 80s, only they're updated to 2021, which I didn't think I'd actually see covering Belfast as I have for the last few years. Yeah. Naomi Long, she's leading of the Centrist Alliance Party here. She was in the parliament in Northern Ireland yesterday. And this is what she said about how she was taking it all in.
I watched adults old enough to be their parents, old enough to know better, standing by, cheering and goading and encouraging young people on as they wreaked havoc in their own community.
Wow. So what can political leaders do in this moment to quell that unrest?
Well, they're trying to basically tell people to back off and calm down. But the fundamental problems, which is the future of Northern Ireland, it's hard to resolve because there is this border in the Irish Sea. There's also frustration over the way Sinn Féin, the former, which used to represent the Irish Republican Army politically, how they seem to have gotten away with some things with coronavirus and a funeral last year. So those tensions are long-lasting, and we're just going to have to see what happens tonight. There's more violence is expected.
NPR's Frank Langfitt reporting from West Belfast. Thank you, Frank.
Great to talk, Rachel.
All right, so after the two mass shootings, one in Atlanta, one in Boulder, President Biden announced new executive action on guns. In Colorado, though, there's still some opposition against any stricter measures.
Immediately after the mass shooting in a Boulder grocery store, some Democrats in Colorado said they wanted to pass the most restrictive firearm laws they could, including a statewide assault-style weapons ban, but talks to do that are stalling.
Benta Berglin of Colorado Public Radio is here with us to talk more. Benta, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So just explain exactly what kinds of changes, what were the range of changes floated after the shooting at the Boulder store?
Well, following the mass shooting at the King Soopers grocery store, some Democrats at the state capitol really began talking about pushing forward with a statewide assault-style weapons ban. Colorado's government is controlled by Democrats, like you said, but there's this strong outdoor gun culture here. I spoke with a number of politically engaged gun owners across the state. They all told me they are against a potential assault weapons ban. Here's Mario Acevedo. He lives in Denver. He's a novelist and a Democratic voter.
When Colorado passed the universal background check and the high-capacity magazine ban, that was done under the premise that it was going to prevent mass shootings. The state passed the red flag, the ERPO law. That, again, was done on the premise of preventing mass shootings. And it didn't.
Advocates for tougher gun laws say gun prevention policies do save lives and that it takes a comprehensive approach to chip away at the problem. In Colorado, most gun deaths are due to suicides. And it can be difficult to quantify the exact number of deaths that didn't happen.
Okay, so we heard there in that clip, not even all Democratic voters are on the same page about any move on gun control. What about Democratic lawmakers in the state?
Initially, yes, support came from Democrats in high positions, and it looked like it could gain momentum. But now a statewide assault-style weapons ban seems less likely. I spoke with State Representative Tom Sullivan. He's a Democrat whose son was killed in the Aurora movie theater shooting in 2012. In many ways, he's been the public face of this debate in Colorado. But he told me right now, he does not think this is the best path forward. He says he wants to focus efforts on policies he believes would be more effective at preventing gun violence.
So you can ban all you want, and they work around it, you know, with printers at home or ordering piece by piece that has no serial number on it, and they manufacture, you know, something that could be deemed as an assault weapon.
We should just note that there was federal action on this very issue. President Biden wants to regulate do-it-yourself weapons kits. Colorado Public Radio spoke with Democratic Governor Jared Polis last afternoon, and he also said he didn't want to focus energy on the type of firearm that was used in the Boulder mass shooting.
I'm not concerned about the model of the gun at this point. Why was he able to buy a weapon when he had a recent conviction for a violent offense?
So if the desire for a statewide assault-style weapon ban is diminishing, what, if anything else, are lawmakers pushing?
Right. Well, Democrats in Colorado seem to be unified on the need for federal action there, but there are less controversial ideas being put forward in the state, like requirements to safely store firearms. Governor Polis also wants to strengthen background checks and make more people aware of the red flag gun law, which allows the courts to temporarily remove firearms from people who are determined to be a danger to themselves or others. So it's been reported that the family in the case of the King Soopers shooting were not aware it could have been used as a resource for them.
Colorado Public Radio's Benta Berglin, thank you.
Thanks.
And that is up first for this Friday, April 9th. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep, with thanks to the people who produced this program.
Indeed. Up First is produced by Nina Kravinsky. Our editors are Kelly Dickens and Mohamed El-Bardisi. Our music is composed by Nick Dupre and Louis Weeks. And our executive producer is Kenya Young.
And don't forget, Up First comes your way on Saturday. Lulu Garcia-Navarro and Scott Simon have the news. It's in this feed or wherever you get your podcasts.
A lot of big corporations have taken stands against a new voting law in Georgia. This seems important.
But I just don't think we should have illusions that there's a beating heart of gold under Coca-Cola.com Corporation Incorporated trademark.
So-called corporate boycotts. Friday afternoon on It's Been a Minute from NPR.